Welcome to the podcast that is all about self-employment. We'll be sharing expertise on getting started, getting noticed, and getting it right, as well as dealing with getting it wrong. Your host, Julia Kermode, will help you get ahead so you get the success you deserve.
Well, welcome to today's podcast. I'm delighted to be joined by Liz Johnson. And so welcome, Liz. Liz is best known as a Paralympian swimmer. She won medals at 3 Paralympics, gold in Beijing, silver in Athens, and bronze in London. So, I mean, that's really impressive. Given that the Paralympics is every 4 years, that's a good 12 years worth of medal achievement, which is absolutely fantastic. And as well as that, she's been a world and European champion on multiple occasions. So massive congratulations. That's huge for me, who is very unsporty. I'm full of admiration. And then since your very successful sports career, Liz, you've earned success as a media commentator, public speaker, athlete mentor, and community ambassador. So you've done huge amounts since then as well. And now we're talking to you as MD of the Ability People and also the online app Podium. So you've found your way to the world of recruitment, and we're delighted to have you. Is there anything you want to add in relation to your background? Because it's impossible to sum up in a couple of sentences.
No, I think you've covered most things. I think it was important to note that I was very fortunate, I guess, that Parasport came to fruition at a time where I was the right age to benefit from that, but I always paired it with education, just because, like I said, it's become more elite and it's become more of an opportunity to have it as a career. But the thing with sport is that it's never guaranteed, because you're only as good as your body will hold up for, or like the people you're racing. So it was always important to have a back plan. And I think, so my degree, my education, my interest was always in business. And so it's fair to say that like sport helped me, and I was able to always marry the two up. So first of all, in my earlier years when I was going through my education, and when I graduated and I managed to swim alongside my other commitments, with my sponsors and stuff, but they knew that I was interested in business, and that was where I wanted to go post swimming. And I retired, so they were always very good actually at involving me in those processes and keeping me in that field and testing me and challenging me, so that I didn't just wake up when I retired and like the 18-year-old at school and not have any context. So I think business world was always where I wanted to end up.
Well, that's fantastic. So you always had kind of half an eye on where you wanted to be once your sports career had finished. So that's really, really interesting. I'm not sure all sports people do that, but I don't know. The world of sport is not my world at all. So tell us a little bit about the One Workforce idea. So obviously I've done some research around you, but our listeners won't necessarily know very much at all. How did that idea come about? And was there anything specific that led to it?
Yeah, so the concept of One Workforce that we kind of used to as the root of everything at the Ability People did come about because we were looking at increasing meaningful employment opportunities for people with disabilities. And often when we first started out, our conversations were all around inclusion and diversity, as they always should be, but we kept getting met by this idea that someone's budget was going on a specific demographic within diversity. So it might be the gender pay gap, or it might be disability, or it might be BAME, or any other of the number of characteristics that are protected. And we were like, well, actually, by doing that, you might increase diversity, but you're not being inclusive. And actually, the idea that what we really want to do is normalize difference. So that because we're all different, whether we have got a diagnosis or a particular characteristic or trait that sets us apart from others, every single person has preference. And as a result, we're all different, and therefore diversity is everywhere. And if you get inclusion right, then diversity becomes a byproduct of that. But you can focus on increasing diversity, but you don't necessarily get authentic inclusion. So the idea of One Workforce is this idea of normalizing difference so that we can all just exist as one.
Yeah, So from what you're saying, is that was it your experience that some firms were focusing on one part of inclusion rather than looking at it in the whole?
Yeah, absolutely. And but also not just firms and organizations, but that's how the world works. Like we've seen during the last 10 months now of the pandemic that actually when people are reacting to a situation that needs fixing, in inverted commas, they naturally do what's going to suit the majority or suit a targeted group. Whereas actually, if you focus on everyone as a whole and maximizing inclusion, then you sort out and you remove a lot of unnecessary barriers all at the same time. And then what happens is the people who are reliant on that benefit, but so do a much wider range of people, because back to what I just said, everyone has preference. So then it allows every individual within the workforce to choose their optimum working conditions or their optimum working situation and environment. And actually that brings the best out of everybody, because then they can get an overall balance of their lives and be invested in what they're doing in the workplace rather than it be all consuming for them. And then maybe they don't enjoy it as much as they can, or they're not able to give as much as they can because they're being restricted in how they behave or how they deliver or how they interact.
Yeah, so I guess, is it about not assuming one size fits all? Because that's what certainly large organisations do with their staff. You know, you all work the same hours in the same office or whatever, and people don't necessarily stop to think about different preferences and how to get the best out of people and therefore the best productivity for the business.
Yeah, I think, you know, especially in larger organisations, for efficiency, it's always been deemed that actually we'll use this system, we'll use this process, and it will filter out and almost funnel in the right people for the roles. But like when you're talking about diversity and inclusion, but the power of diversity and the reason that diversity is necessary, I mean, people now focus on diversity because it's the right thing to do and it makes sense and it will reflect society. But actually diversity is a strength. Because you've got difference within your organization, difference around the table when you're planning, difference around your day-to-day. Like people can react then differently and put different ideas forward and have different discussions. And hopefully it means you don't all get stuck at the same point. You can navigate barriers because people have got different experiences, different mindsets. So that strength of diversity is important. But actually sometimes the idea of like, funneling down and getting people in, that doesn't always allow for diversity to come through. And I don't mean necessarily, again, I don't mean diversity of particular types of people in inverted commas. I mean diversity of ideas or diversity of the way that you present or diversity of your background. Because actually what we know now is that we're all products of our experiences and our backgrounds, and that's what makes us who we are. And so whilst I think it's absolutely a limiting factor that people, time is money, right? That's the and so people have like gone down this path of having a process. It works works for the majority, but then what talent are you missing out on? Who else is out there that could better your business? And I guess that's the athlete in me. The athlete in me is very much like, well, do you want to do what you've always been doing and get what you've always got, or and survive and function and probably be like, you know, do well in the market? Or do you want to be innovative? Do you want to be better than everybody else? Do you want to be the organization that people look to, that people come to? And actually, I think more and more as we move into 2021, I think people have conscience and consumers have conscience, and actually, now they will be like, oh no, I'm going to choose this organization over that organization because of the their ethics or because of their social impact or because. And so I think it is becoming increasingly important to consider those things.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Just I'm sitting here nodding along, and you know, just from my own personal kind of experience and how my attitudes have changed over the years. And people are much more inclined to choose companies on a more ethical basis than they ever have been, aren't they? Which is exactly what you're saying. So with this kind of one workforce idea, how receptive have companies been that when you've been talking to them about it?
I think the good thing is organisations are very receptive. They know that it's the right thing to do, but they also can see the benefit, like both financially and socially. But I think, again, like some people, depending on the size of the organisation and the restrictions of who's signing off the budget, like people's hands can sometimes be tied, but that's because I think often they still view it as they're doing a good deed and it's a choice rather than it's actually a right. Like it's a right that everybody has an equitable experience. So we're moving away from this idea that society has, that the perfect human exists and we're all trying to aspire to be that person. And I think so often that's driven in the past. So then people think they're doing you a favor, or it's a charity thing, and actually no, it's not. We need to move the dial with that and change people's thinking to the fact that like, it's not an add-on. It's not a consideration if time allows or if the budget allows.
Yeah.
This should be a priority.
Absolutely. And it sometimes seems like it's a nice to have in people's thinking, whereas actually dealing with, you know, differences in anybody should, as you say, it should be a right. And there is no difference. If you've got two people with the same skills that can do what you want them to do, then whether someone is more able physically than another person is neither here nor there, so long as they get the job done, right?
Absolutely. And I think, like we always try to say, think about it from the angle of if the month that you were born affected whether you were eligible to get that job or not. So someone born in February and someone born in June have got exactly the same qualifications, exactly the same experience, are both as capable of doing their job. But the person born in June doesn't get to apply because the process only accepts people that were born in February. Like, is that fair? No.
Fundamentally unfair. Yeah.
Absolutely. But when you say it like that, people are like, oh, of course. But that's what I'm saying. That's why we have to move the dial on our thinking about what disability actually means and what it represents. Because I think historically, people with disabilities weren't given the same opportunities, even in terms of going to school, even in terms of accessing the academic system. Like 50 years ago, able-bodied people or perceived able-bodied people went to mainstream school, and people with disabilities, no matter what it was, went to a different school, call it special school, like whatever you want to call it, but they used to get bussed off to another school. And so the problem with that is that's what that generation associate disability to mean.
But the
world has changed for the better. And like I said, it's not just disability, which is why we try to talk about this one workforce and normalizing difference, because actually we're all in these situations, and actually a lot of people live with disabilities that are invisible or even undiagnosed, but it doesn't mean that they wouldn't benefit from a more accessible, open-minded working environment.
Yeah, and what you're saying there about disabled people going to a different school, I remember when I was at school that happened, and you know, I don't think I'm that old, but we're going back kind of 30 years or so now, and it only exacerbates that difference and perceptions that you know, I guess people then when they meet someone disabled think, oh, I don't quite know how to cope with this because you're different, and so then I think you tell me, but I think that it's people's perceptions of it that need to change, because just because someone is less able-bodied than another person, they're still a person.
Absolutely. And they can actually, with the right assistance and equipment and environment, they can achieve the same as anybody else. They might not achieve it in the same way, and actually, but you make a really good point with what you're saying, and actually that is fundamentally what we focus everything at the ability of people around, like this idea of increased exposure to disability, increased education around it, and increased empathy for disability, Those three E's of education, exposure, and empathy, if you can continually increase those, because you're not going to know everything. Of course you're not, especially if you've never met somebody with a disability before. And the chances are you have, but you might not realize. And I think we're so programmed to judge based on what we can see, and it can be so restrictive. And we do it all the time. And we all have our unconscious biases and our prejudices, but it's learning to be aware of them and not let them impact your decision-making when you're dealing with humans. And exactly as you said, we're all individuals, and we all have limitations, but there are limitations. Like for me, for example, I'm not a good artist, and I definitely can't sing. Right. So there's certain things I'm not good at, and I know that, but it's not because of my disability. It's because of who I am. That's the important thing to note, is that actually a person with a disability, just like female, male, like we're at a point where now, if we were still going to a workplace and there was no females, it would be very noticeable.
Yes.
But again, 50, 60 years ago, if females did work, there was a small pocket of type of job role that they did.
And
it's unfathomable. And this is the thing with disability, is actually, and like, this is why I think having been a Paralympian, it helped, because when I was starting out, the Paralympics, yes, it existed, but it didn't exist in the form it is now. And it didn't have the coverage it's got now, or the understanding that it's got now. And so it took 25 years to get to that point, but I went through it and I know it's possible. And then just like, if it happened in the sporting industry, why can't it happen in other, sectors of life? That's my main feeling. And that's why we have the ability. That's why we exist. And it's not about telling people what they're doing wrong. It's about helping them on the adventure of understanding, because you can't be blamed for knowing what you've never needed to know before. Like, we say that a lot as well. And I think there's this level of fear that surrounds disability. And I think it's because, again, it's the one protective characteristic that none of us are immune to. Like, anybody can become disabled at any time. Anyone can acquire a disability or an impairment any time. And at various times in our lives, every single one of us are disabled in some way. And so therefore, I think that's another thing, is actually, it's sometimes a little close to home for people. Like, it can be a bit scary, but it's because, like you said, you don't get the exposure to it to normalize the difference. And that's what we try to do with the ability people.
And I was going to talk to you about the Paralympics anyway, because that for me has really changed people's perceptions. And, you know, it just shows that if we can change perceptions within the sports world, which is full of kind of elite, successful, high achievers, then surely we can get that step change elsewhere. And, you know, it's that your perception that the Paralympics has had that big an impact.
Yes, absolutely. The Paralympics has done amazing things for showing people what is possible with a disability, if you want to be and have the capability to be an elite athlete. And I think the great thing about sport, and you hear it all the time, sport has the power to change the world. And that is true, because so many people have an affinity to sport or an experience of it, whether it is that they have aspirations to be the best in the world, or whether they do it socially, or they do it to keep fit, or they did it at school and they hated it. Like, whatever it is, everybody experiences sport in some way, even if you turn on Match of the Day on Saturday evening and just catch up on the football for the week, you know? So people can relate to it in some form. And I think that's been very powerful in getting people to understand what is possible with a disability. But again, like I said, if you want to be an athlete, I think I said now where the education then needs to happen is to contextualize that, because you meet people who are like blown away by the Paralympics and how amazing the achievements are and how strong the athletes are and how they adapt their training and all these things. but then they still don't have them in their workforce. And I don't mean they don't have Paralympians in their workforce. They don't have people with disabilities in their workforce. Or they have them there, but they're not aware of them. Or they have them there and they're aware of them, but they still make them work like everybody else, or expect them to function in the same way as everybody else, and don't understand like why they're not attracted to their organization, or where are they? And like, you know, so again, another thing, it's all about contextualizing that and bringing those lessons that the Paralympic movement has shown us in a sporting world and relating them to the real world. Because the Olympics and the Paralympics, it's not the real world for many people, right? Which is why many people make it. And that's fine. But like the majority of the population look to go to work, to earn money, to pay their bills and live their life. That's what the majority, so why is it that we're so far behind in making that happen?
Yeah, there's a real disconnect there, isn't there? Because, you know, people will watch sport. Most people will have something that they'll watch, whatever it might be. If there are disabled people in most sports now, I would hope. It's a shame that people watch that on the telly and then don't kind of draw the parallels from it. And, you know, what sort of barriers do disabled people face when they're looking for work?
I think the barriers can be endless, you know, because we so often focus in on the moment that we're in. So we look at the immediate situation of maybe a person's work environment or a person's start time, but things like, even certain things like a lot of business corporate clothing that you're expected to wear is not comfortable for certain people with certain disabilities.
Okay.
Or the lighting in an environment might not be great for some people with visual impairments or sensory concerns, or just the sheer number and volume of people that exist. You know, if you've got high levels of anxiety or a mental health condition, that means you're not good in those situations. It's all of them. So I think sometimes we look at the barriers like, is there a lift and is there a ramp and what height is the desk? And again, it comes back to this idea of what is disability and how we view it. And like, we're so used to disability being depicted by a wheelchair symbol, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, there's plenty of other disabilities out there that need other considerations. And so the barriers are endless. But I think also in terms of like there's physical barriers, there's communication barriers, and then there's sensory barriers. And if you use those three categories as a way to look, you'll cover off a lot of the barriers when you're looking, or you can like at least not compartmentalize them, but at least attribute them to one of those categories.
Yeah,
and so that covers a number of different disabilities or conditions or impairments, whatever word you want to use. And so it's about thinking of the person as a whole and how their day-to-day life is affected. It's like we've had situations where we've been delivering workshops at like breakfast meetings. And a number of our, and often it's in London or one of the big cities. And then you have to drive because the rush hour is not set up for a lot of people with disabilities.
Yeah, of course.
Like nobody is that considerate of a person. Like I know people with guide dogs that get tutted at on the escalators in the tube stations because their guide dog, who is trained obviously to stand by the side of them because that's how they're getting
to guide them.
And they're holding up people from running up the left side of the escalator. And you're like, hang on a second, where's your privilege here? Why do you deserve to get up this escalator any more than I do? Why should I, obviously not me, I don't have a visual impairment or a guide dog, but why should I be the one that stands at the bottom of the escalator and wait for all of you people to go before I then go, why is that on me? And actually, that's what you do a lot of the time as a person who has a disability. That you do. You sometimes will partly sacrifice yourself and your own time and your own energies just to make life easier, just for less resistance. But even things like considering things like that, or like we've had it where some of our team who are wheelchair users have got to train stations and they're like, oh yeah, nobody operates the ramp at this time of the morning, so the first train that you'll be able to get on is at 9:14. And you're like, okay, that's not okay. But the point then is, when you back to your question about barriers, how is that person then with this situation and with people who don't understand that, then supposed to be able to then go for a top job, go for one of the more senior positions and go, oh, by the way, I won't be here till 10 because the train doesn't come till 9:14. Because the reality is the majority of people don't understand that. They never have had to consider that. Or when you're booking train assistants, I'm picking on the trains now, but again, we all need to get to work, right? So when you're booking train assistants, you have to give 24 hours notice. Well, how often have able-bodied people been in a meeting and it's run over, so they've got the next train, or it's finished early and they've gone home? Well, you can't do that. So you could be in the middle of a really important deal and go, oh, sorry, my train's going, I have to go now because my, if I don't get on the train, I won't be able to get the train. Like, it's laughable, but it's so easy to fix. But then it means that then people drive. But then when you're driving in London, we all know that driving in London is not practical and it's not the desired way to travel. But for some, it's the only option. But then there's never anywhere to park. And there's and it all starts to. So when we talk about barriers, they are endless, I think. But it's having awareness that they exist, because yes, some you can remove, some you have to negotiate, but it's a lot more comfortable negotiating them if you don't feel like you're doing it alone. And also you can be open and honest about them. With the trains, okay, someone's got to operate the ramp. But why has somebody got to operate the ramp? Because that's not an equitable experience. If you had parts of the platform that were raised and stair level access, access, then you wouldn't need a ramp operator.
Exactly.
And again, this is that whole then that systemic prejudice that exists, that actually, well, a person with a disability wouldn't possibly need to go to work. So why would they need a train before 8 o'clock or before 7 a.m.? Like, and that's what we're up against here. And that's what we're trying to re-educate. Because again, you're not, if you don't have your attention brought to it, you're unaware of it. And you can't blame for that. But then ignorance can't be, it can be a reason, but it can't be an excuse.
Yeah, and I'm sort of laughing at a few of the points you're raising there, because they are so silly and easily resolvable. And it just, again, like I said earlier, it just makes those differences even more so. So like, you know, the train station are like, oh, well, I hope no one disabled comes in before such and such a time because they need special treatment. Well, actually, no, they shouldn't need special treatment. You should be able to just get on a train and get out and about. I find it very frustrating, some of the things you're saying. And I hope our listeners are finding it very frustrating, because that will get the message across.
Yeah. And so within the workplace, there are a number of barriers, and quite often in terms of actually getting to a job, there's barriers involved in the recruitment process and how people present themselves and then how people are able to demonstrate their capabilities and things like that. But like, I think so often people miss the bits before that, or the bits like I said, like at the beginning of your question, like when I was answering, like so often we focus on the here and now and the immediate, but actually it's more than that, you know, like there's more to consider when we're talking about barriers.
Yeah. And so in terms of thinking of kind of the recruitment process for people looking for jobs, I mean, do people feel the need to label themselves? Do they have to kind of, or do people apply for jobs and then deal with it later? Because the labeling themselves at the outset, does that cause problems, you know, with potential discrimination? And, you know, recruiters and hirers should never be discriminatory, but I guess people have barriers there to how they see other people, you know, unconsciously. So what are your thoughts around that sort of thing?
I'm a firm believer that in terms of volunteering, any additional information should be your personal choice, right? The one thing again that we promote and we champion when we're helping organizations with their recruitment processes is this idea that you shouldn't need to declare anything different.
That's
the reality. And yes, and absolutely, you get people who don't and people who do. And again, it's dependent on what your role's doing. If your situation will impact or impede or your ability to get this role, then you might be inclined, but you shouldn't have to, because again, like you said, that then comes up, oh, are they going to judge me for that? Or are they going to jump to a conclusion? Whereas actually what we really want is recruitment processes that don't require that, because you should, like, we're at the point now where you don't have to say if you're male or female. And I used the example earlier of birth dates. We could use that again, you know, like, or eye color or anything. Like, if your eye color distinguished whether you were, like, or determined whether you were eligible for a job or not, like, what would that be all about? And so you have to, and when that's where we want to get to, an equitable recruitment process where every individual is judged purely based on their skill set and their experience and the relevance that they will have in the role that they are applying for. And I think it shouldn't be that difficult. And often it isn't. It's sometimes just down to the reorganizing the layout of a form or rewording the question or offering. And like, again, I get another thing we say is, if you offer up regular intervals with the application process for people to volunteer any information they want, it doesn't have to be that they have a disability. It could be that they live 3 hours away from where the test center is going to be, or the assessment center is going to be, or the event, or the environment where the interviews are going to happen. And so, can I please have a slot in the afternoon, because the trains, again, I haven't gone back to the trains, but or like the traffic or whatever, I can't get there for that time, or I don't drive, or like, so it doesn't, so what happens then is you level the playing field for everybody, and you make it equitable so that everybody has their best chance to succeed. And that, in terms of recruitment processes, that's what they don't do at the moment. And they're made up, sometimes they're complex and they're made up of lots of different sections, and there's lots of different systems involved, and there's lots of different parties involved, and there's a lot of room to have a very different experience at different points of the process. But actually what we want to create is this environment where people can present their best selves, however they do that. And ultimately those recruiting end up knowing that they have placed the best person for the job.
And then in terms of kind of your online app, so I want to get into that a little bit. So it's called Podium, and it's all about connecting freelancers with employers of them. And it's freelancers who largely work from home, I think, who might be home-based because of their disability, but maybe because that's their choice. So tell us a little bit about that and how it works.
I think with Podium, what we were looking to do is just create an opportunity, an alternative opportunity for meaningful employment. And quite often when you speak to the community of anyone who's different, like we're talking specifically here about people with disabilities, but is that they have ended up freelancing or working in environments that they have complete control over in order to optimize their everyday life and ensure that they're not sacrificing themselves, and why should they? Mm-hmm. But they're also then, their work doesn't suffer because of it. And I think one of the biggest things that Podium does is provides transparency, because around difference in disability specifically, like I've said it before, but there's often this fear of like, how do I ask that question, or will I offend, or simply candidate if I tell them, are they going to judge me or jump to a conclusion? Whereas by getting involved in Podium, candidates have already acknowledge that they have a disability or an impairment of some kind that impacts them. They wouldn't be then putting themselves forward for roles, all time to there, if they couldn't do them. So you remove that element of the unspoken questions, but simply for the organization, it provides them with the security of knowing, well, okay, this person has an impairment, but it's irrelevant. Because I'm just looking for someone that can do the job. And actually now I don't have to ask the question, because again, they wouldn't have been putting themselves forward for it if they couldn't do it. So it provides like that first step to embracing this journey. And then it's left, and it just makes it then a professional service. Organizations post opportunities, and then freelancers connect with those organizations and offer their services. They set their price, discuss all the terms and the time scales and all of those things, and then they do the deal, the work gets done, they submit it, once the organization is happy, they say yes, accepted, and then the freelancer gets their payment.
Yeah, and that I suppose is one of the great things about being self-employed is that because it's not employment, then the business that you're conducting work for doesn't need to get involved in all of this HR stuff, because it's a business-to-business relationship, and actually none of that matters, providing you as a freelancer are delivering what you say you're going to deliver. So it kind of simplifies things in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it just provides that other avenue, because actually you meet a lot more freelancers these days anyway, in life generally. A lot of people have moved towards freelancing or self-employment because it suits the lifestyle that they need away from the workplace. But again, a lot of freelancers are either in that, either, like if it's in broadcasting or, you know, video or something like that, then they've grown up in that world, so to speak. And so then they've made their connections that way. And then a lot of other freelancers that you speak to have come out of a full-time role or a permanent role or a long-time contractual role, and they've started to, like, so again, they have that contact base and they have those connections. Whereas again, one of the barriers, I guess, in the disability demographic is that that hasn't always been the case for aforementioned reasons. Like, they don't always get the same opportunities, and therefore they might not have a foot in the door, or they might not have, their name might not be recognizable, whatever, but this provides them an opportunity to start building up their portfolio. Or if they're already established, then they can still continue to use it, but it's just another avenue to connect with more organizations and more meaningful employment opportunities.
Yeah, and that's fantastic, actually, because one of the things that I'm quite keen on is supporting people when they're kind of starting to find work. And I think at the moment because of the pandemic, there's all sorts of different things going on out there and people needing to find different ways of work. But from what you're saying from the app is that even if you're kind of disabled and at the start of your career, you can still potentially find opportunities through it.
Well, yeah, and absolutely, like with anything to do with being a freelancer or self-employed, it's like kind of that you get better at looking for work and accepting work and knowing how systems work. And so you start to, like, and it's true, like there's people on the platform already that you can see have kind of got into the rhythm now of when they check in, how they connect, like where the work comes from. And it'll continue to grow, this idea. Like, it's what you don't want is a flash in the pan. It, like, a slow burner is better as people gravitate towards it and get positive experiences from it and then come back. And there's nothing to say, right, that then one of those freelancers, if they have reoccurring work with the same organization, eventually the organization might be like, actually, is there a way that we can employ you? Like, that is a possibility. It's not out of the question. But again, that freelancer might not want the commitment. And not because they're not committed, but just because maybe they have a medical condition that fluctuates, and therefore they don't want to put themselves in that position where they're at risk of they're not completing a task or completing a role or something like that. Because again, that is often, I think, what people overlook, like in terms of barriers, when we're talking about barriers, just to go back to that, is that subconscious anxiety that someone who is different has. Like, because everything has got more onus on it. Everything has got more, there's more at stake, because you're like, okay, if I mess this up, they're going to blame it on that. It's all about giving the individual control. It's just another way of giving the individual control their environment and their situation to maximize their output and potential.
Yeah, and I guess being empowered in that way as well, then people can pick and choose who they want to work for ultimately. So wouldn't it be great if you're a freelancer on Podium and someone's saying, oh, well, I want you to work for us permanently. And you go, actually, no, I'm quite happy working for you in this way, but I also like to work for them as well. And, you know, and just to be able to have that choice would be fantastic.
Yeah, and again, like I said, it helps navigate the complexities that everybody's dealing with in their everyday life, right?
Yeah. And just thinking, obviously, we're in January 2021, so we've experienced the year of the pandemic. Hopefully people will be listening to this in years to come and have no idea what we're talking about. Wouldn't that be brilliant? But obviously, we've seen a lot of businesses in the last year moving their workforce to mainly working from home. And do you think that has helped with kind of disability issues? And do you think firms are more likely to be able to make adjustments for people?
I absolutely think that the one of the positive things to come out of the pandemic is that exactly that, in terms of it's shown what's possible with remote working. It's shown how life can still function. It's also shown that it's not for everybody. And therefore, what I hope doesn't happen is when if we ever return to the world, that we're all back in
this place. Let's assume we will.
But what I really hope doesn't happen is then working from home becomes the go-to for anybody who's different in any way that can't fit in to...
Oh, yes.
And a lot of people haven't thought of this, but it's this, again, what we don't want then is the choice to be removed, but just in a different way. But I think it absolutely has opened up doors for people who will benefit from working at home. And also, I think one of the things about being empathetic sometimes is it's difficult to have empathy for a situation that you've never experienced or never understood. Whereas I think now, there's not many people that haven't worked from home. Or if their job allowed it, do you know what I mean? Like the ones that haven't and never and are not in careers where anybody's going to work from home. But everybody who is in a career that is possible to work from home by now has probably done it, I would say, or majority of the population. And therefore, they will have experienced the highs and the lows of it. They will experience the challenges. And so, no, they won't make that assumption when they're back in the office going, oh, yeah, Joe Blogs at home is just, you know, they can get coffee whenever they want and can do it. Like, they don't appreciate, but there are still challenges that exist and they might be more empathetic towards those. So I do, but one thing I do think is it's, if nothing else, it's shown that it is possible. And actually I hope it's done is show that actually it takes a certain mentality to succeed at that. So therefore, actually, I would hope that then more value is put on that individual's character, personality and skill set, aside from just being able to output for the job and what else they can bring to the team. So that's what I hope comes out. And yes, it does. I think then hopefully people now won't just look at a form or look at somebody's situation or see them and judge them and think, oh, well, they're not for us.
Yeah, you're quite right. There's still that risk of almost pigeonholing people. And yes, we've had enormous progress in people working from home. But just because someone might have a disability doesn't automatically mean they have to work from home. So I think that's a really, really good point.
And there's also this idea that, like, I know I've got neighbours who have found it really, really difficult working from home because they've got children that they've got to homeschool and then they can't wait to get back to the office, right? So what we also need to do is make sure that those people that didn't have a positive experience of it, don't let that then negatively impact how they think it might work for somebody else. And I think that goes back to an earlier part of our discussion around being aware of our unconscious biases or our biases, actually, because then they become biased, right? Because we're aware of them. Like being aware of them and checking them and ensuring that we're not letting them influence our behaviours and decision making for anybody else.
Yeah, and you know that's a really interesting point as well, because lots of people have really enjoyed working from home, and not everyone has, as you've said. And it just illustrates one size doesn't fit all. And you know, you can have introverted people who really hate being in a big open plan office. And I do know someone who actually rejected a job offer. This was going back many, many years, because she felt she couldn't work in an open plan office, and it just wasn't for her. And so you have different types of people anyway, regardless of physical ability. And I think I'm hoping that this experience will make businesses a bit more aware of those differences throughout their whole team.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, there's always ways to remove barriers or navigate obstacles. And I think that is important. That's when it comes back to this idea of increasing people's comfort level around difference, so that discussions can happen and they can take place without judgment, without restrictions, without reservation, so that ultimately you create that environment that optimizes everyone's performance. Because ultimately we do, like you said, we all have preference, we all have choice, but actually this is not a do-gooder thing or a choice to get involved in. This is a requirement.
Yeah, it's basic stuff, isn't it? You know, and the more it becomes ingrained in businesses, the better. Because if you have a workforce made up of different types of people, you have different viewpoints, but also then if you can enable them to succeed, I mean, wow, that's a massive advantage over your competitors. If you've got different viewpoints within that business and different perceptions, then that's massive, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And we're all going to have different perceptions because of our experience. Of life, that's what makes us who we are. But it's just being aware of how they influence our actions and our decisions, I think. And we make assumptions. We're all guilty of that. But it's how we control those and how we ensure that they don't impact another person negatively or ourselves negatively. Sometimes they impact ourselves negatively, right? So so it's very. I think it's important to just. I keep saying this, but it like. Everybody deserves an equitable experience.
Yeah, you're so right. And, you know, I don't necessarily want to go back to kind of the train discussion in particular, but that really, really illustrates the point, doesn't it? We've all got the right to use public transport. We all pay for it. You know, why shouldn't we all have the same experience of that? Okay, well, I think that probably covers most things that I wanted to talk about. Liz, is there anything you wanted to kind of say to finish off with?
I think this is great that this conversation is happening more and more, but I think the one thing now is like 2020 gave us all a chance to think and take a step back and reset. And I think moving forward, we're all going to have to change the way that we operate, like personally, professionally, physically, socially, emotionally, with our senses. And so it makes sense for now that we have accessibility at the forefront of every decision that we're making, so that actually it doesn't become a barrier, it doesn't become an obstacle, and it doesn't become a cost of a question of cost or time or efficiency generally. Because actually, if you start at the root, then it's kind of that short-term sacrifice for a long-term gain. Because once it becomes embedded in the way you operate as an individual or as an organization, then it's done. And actually, you're always going to get your odd case that is a one in a million. But it's having, again, like I said, that confidence and comfort level then to be able to discuss that and know that you're equipped to assist that individual, rather than having this constant idea where we're constantly sending a whole group of people into a reasonable adjustments process.
Yeah, it shouldn't be about adjustments and that it should be a lot more ingrained. And that's one of the really, really important messages, I think, from this conversation. Thank you so, so much for joining us. Hopefully we'll keep in touch. And hopefully, I mean, I don't know, maybe we could get you back on in a year's time and see how things have changed in that time. But we'll see. But anyway, I've really, really enjoyed talking to you. And I think it's been really, really helpful for our listeners. So thank you so much, Liz.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to All About Self-Employment, hosted by Julia Kermode. For more information on today's discussion, please visit iwork.co.uk, where you can also join our growing community. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, then we would love you to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. We'll be back at the same time next week.